Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. You can join the conversation this morning, as always, by emailing us panel@wamc.org. Our panelists this morning are preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you for being here as ever. We're also joined by Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead, Anna Markowitz. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio. Hi, Robert.
Hi. How are you, Sarah?
I'm reasonably well, thank you.
Reasonably well.
It's
a high bar.
It's chilly out there. That's okay.
Yes,
it's December.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
We've been reporting on this on the station yesterday and today, but we do want to mention at the top of the show this morning, we are grieving the loss of a fantastic longtime roundtable panelist, Dr. Vera Icarius-Kelly, professor of comparative politics at Siena College, was a participant in this program and a friend outside of this program. We are sending comfort and support and time to everyone who knew and loved her, and also, you know, letting you listeners know that many of you were great fans of her work as she was off of the air seeking treatment, hoping to recover and come back. Listeners were missing her and questioning if she would return. We were always hopeful she would, but alas, not on this plane shall she return to the program. And we again send comfort to her friends and family and everyone who knew her. There is a post on WAMC.org, a very brief summation. And when we receive information or the link to the obituary or information about a memorial service, we will update that post. It is devastating, of course, to lose someone, and cancer touches the lives of I don't know somebody whose life hasn't been touched in one way or another that disease. We hope that, you know, funding can continue to be allocated for research into treatments, and again, Flights of Angels. Vera, we love you very much and we'll miss you.
Well said.
Thank you. Terry, you were on with Vera. Did you want to add anything? I'm sorry I didn't ask you ahead of time. It might be rude to put you on the spot this way.
That's okay. Yeah, I remember being on the panel with Vera in person many, many times over the years. And it was always a real pleasure. She was just an extremely nice person that had a very outgoing personality and was just a lot of fun to be around, and also had just a lot of real world, real life experience that was very relevant to the topics that we tend to discuss on the show. And it was always helpful to hear her perspective, and it was always very thought provoking. And my heart goes out to her and her family.
Thank you, Terry. We will miss her, and I'm right now trying to think of a smooth transition into topics of the day. Let us eschew the possibility of me landing on that and jump ham-fistedly into the news discussion. But again, Vera will be in our hearts and on our minds for years to come. Now to this from the New York Times. Top Democrats are calling for the release of a classified video of the U.S. military's first operation targeting a boat in the Caribbean in early September. An attack that has faced heavy scrutiny in part for its follow-up strike that killed two survivors. Democrats and Republicans have offered starkly different descriptions of the video, which was seen by some members of Congress last week but has not yet been made public. Republicans in Congress have maintained that the video of the September 2nd strike on the boat carrying 11 individuals showed the survivors trying to flip a capsized boat, rescue its cargo, and continue to traffic drugs. Representative Adam Smith of Washington, the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, says that's simply not accurate. Quote, "It seems pretty clear they don't want to release the video because they don't want people to see it, because that second strike, the follow-up strike, is difficult to justify." Mr. Smith said this in an interview with ABC's This Week on Sunday. Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, a top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, who, like Mr. Smith, saw the video in a closed-door briefing last week, told CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday that the two survivors were barely alive, much less engaging in hostilities when the follow-up strike took place. President Trump said on Wednesday that he would have no problem making the classified video public, but Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said that he might not release the footage because he did not want to compromise sources and methods. On Tuesday, Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican of Arkansas, said he would support the release of the classified video, but gave no indication that he would press the Pentagon to do so. Excuse me. The Trump administration has so far carried out 22 known attacks on boats suspected of trafficking drugs. The total number of people killed reached 87 last week with a strike on December 4th on a vessel in the Eastern Pacific. U.S. Southern Command said the boat was operated by a designated terrorist organization and carrying narcotics, but has provided no evidence for those allegations. Terry, would you like to begin?
Well, what strikes me as interesting is just how different individuals, mostly divided by party, have apparently seen the same video and have come out with just really completely different interpretations of what they saw. And it's very striking. And so it does make us want to see this video so that we can assess for ourselves what we believe our eyes are seeing. And it just also reminds me of so many other periods throughout the history of this country, both recent and distant, where actual facts of things that have occurred, especially around U.S. aggression, whether it be against other countries or other people, the narrative of how that story is told is often really different depending on the political bias of the person telling the story and the agenda of the person telling the story. And here we have, once again, the same thing happening. It reminds me a lot, I guess, in the most recent time of our actions in Iraq and the misleading stories that we were told about weapons of mass destruction, and also going back as far as the Vietnam War. There were oftentimes two different stories coming out of that. Always, it's taken time for the American people to have access to what really happened so they can reach the conclusion themselves. And I think it's important that they release these videos.
Robert?
Yeah. At the risk of disagreeing with Terry, I'm actually reassured by precisely the opposite phenomenon. We're seeing Congress, particularly the Republicans in this instance, Tom Cotton and others, lean into their oversight role instead of reflexively backing the administration. And that's what a healthy constitutional system does. So, you know, so that's good to hear. At the risk of diverting us into a different issue, I'm also struck by the language creep, I guess you'd call it here. I mean, cocaine trafficking is obviously a corrosive social evil. Cartels are violent. They're destructive. They are not good guys. But under our longstanding law, drug trafficking is a crime. It is not an act of war. It is not terrorism. It's supposed to be deterred and punished through arrests, through prosecutions, through the courts, not through military action. But back to my principal point, the fact that Congress is taking this seriously and acting as not as a rubber stamp, but as a third co-equal branch of government, I think is one of the healthier things we've seen in a while.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I also like to look at this through the broader lens of, you know, we're not legally at war with Venezuela. And until we are, all 87 of the murders that occurred in the open seas are illegal. We don't just go around shooting people who are suspects in crimes. There should be due process. There should be arrests. We should be capturing people. So I would love to see a look at whether we are at war with Venezuela. Like, we should have Congress vote on that. But with this actual video, I would like to see it released. I do think that even if we were at war with Venezuela, this would be going against the laws of war and would be a war crime. So I do think that we should see it and we should be investigating what types of missiles were used. Was there shrapnel intended to kill people, or was it just trying to destroy the material, the drugs that were on board? Because that is perhaps more of a viable reason to destroy the drugs than to have a shrapnel missile that tries to kill people. But regardless, I mean, I don't think that we should be at war with Venezuela.
Terry?
You know, I think the point about whether this is legal or illegal in terms of what our Constitution says we can do in terms of conducting war. I think that's a really important point. And maybe I missed it, but at least as I recall, the Republicans that came out of that meeting that they saw the video, they shared their opinion about what they saw and whether they thought the actions taken were sort of necessary. But I don't remember the issue of them commenting on whether this was illegal or illegal coming up. They don't seem to really be addressing what many of us believe to be the illegality of this entire process, and instead sort of just focusing on whether these two individuals were rightly or wrongly killed. If the whole operation is ultimately illegal, then not only were they their killing was unjustified, but all the killings were unjustified. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I guess it does remind me very much of sort of what you heard and saw coming out of administrations back during the Vietnam War, where there was all kinds of accusations about what was legal and not legal. And I don't know that we ever really resolved any of that to the degree of getting the full truth.
Ed agrees with you, Terry writes in and says, the second strike is beyond difficult to justify because the first strike was illegal and not justified. That's it. This is murder and then murder again and again and again. No police would be able to get away with this in the United States borders, parentheses, yet. And there is no foundation for military operation in this case. That is from Ed.
Well, I mean, that's precisely the point, right? In other words, the reason, at present, at least, the administration is not classifying this as a police action. They're justifying it as a military action. That is their position. I assume that is, you know, whether it was discussed overtly on the Sunday shows yesterday or not, that almost is inevitably going to be part of congressional oversight when those hearings occur. So just because it wasn't a talking point yesterday doesn't mean it will not be a talking point. But that's exactly the point. Is this a police action? Is this a justifiable use of the military? Anna, you suggested a moment ago that, you know, this is murder. Let's expand the aperture a little bit. This administration is not the first one to use the military in without congressional authorization. I mean, we had drone strikes under Obama and Biden, for example. We are long overdue to have this conversation nationally about what the limits and what is and is not an appropriate use of military force.
Theo writes in and says, if the video of the shipwreck survivors was truly ambiguous, the question about what is shown would be statistically split regardless of political party. The fact that it isn't proves that one side or both sides have an agenda, and that is why we shouldn't be killing people.
That's an interesting point, you know, and I hope they do release the video so that we can all see it. I think we are owed that. But I think if I understand what the writer said is correctly, that to expect that whatever is shown will be interpreted in only one way by the majority of Americans is a mistake. There, no matter what is shown there, just like you have the differing opinions about what they saw between the congressional members, I think you'll see the same thing in the American public. There'll be half the country will see it as one way and half the country will see it as another. I think that's the reality of the world we're living in right now.
I wish I could disagree. That is why I opened by saying I'm heartened to see Congress at least not knee-jerking its the congressional Republicans, not immediately engaging in knee-jerk support, but calling for hearings at the very least. Maybe it's a low bar, but that's a healthy thing.
Maria wrote in to panel at WAMC.org and says, this reminds me of Howard Zinn, probably well known to some subset of WAMC listeners as the progressive historian and former World War II bombardier, commenting on the global war on terror. Different circumstances for sure, but a moral footing I think we'd be wise to keep in mind, says Maria. She then quotes Howard Zinn saying, if the deaths of civilians are inevitable in bombing, it may not be deliberate, but it is not an accident. And if the bombers cannot be, and the bombers cannot be considered innocent, they are committing murder as surely as are the terrorists. Maria continues, Kurt Vonnegut, a local denizen for some time and also a survivor of the U.S.'s bombing of Dresden while he was a prisoner of war there, had similar sentiments. The language around bombing of civilians, even if likely criminals, and the language of warfare more broadly, have been morally bankrupt for generations. That from Maria.
I don't have the data. Go ahead, Terry.
No, 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 go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't have the data in front of me, but I suspect it's probably something like a 10 or 15 to 1 ratio in the last 100 years of using military force without congressional authorization, which, you know, constitutionally they're supposed to get congressional authorization. But ever since the term police action entered the vocabulary, more often than not, it is subject to executive, I don't want to say executive whim, because that sounds like it's capricious, but as a matter of civic hygiene, our executive branch is out of the habit of seeking congressional authorization. So these, you know, these kind of, what's the phrase I want to use? Not mission creep, but, you know, using military force in what some of us at least might consider law enforcement activities, foreign or domestic, is kind of the coin of the realm, has been for several generations now.
Terry?
Well, I was just following up on all of this to agree, I suppose, that, yes, go back as far as I can even think about past presidents, and they've all used the military at one time or another in ways that are somewhat questionable.
Yeah.
And so this it's not new to have an executive doing that. I guess my bigger concern is that the Trump administration has just sort of broken all previous records of pushing the envelope of what an executive can do, and has really demonstrated that there are real limits to being able to hold the presidential administration accountable at this point. If Congress does not seem to be willing to do it, and I'm not even sure exactly how they could do it related to Venezuela at this point, other than taking control of the financial end of it, which they so far seem to not be willing to do. But ultimately, I think it's just going to come down to the American people. It really is just public pressure from the American people is about the only real tool we have to really curb these type of activities at the executive branch level, which I think is why it's important this video be released so the American people can see and decide for themselves. We certainly see that the Supreme Court is just over and over again giving the presidential administration and what ultimately will be future presidential administrations more and more and more power. So I don't see how we stop this without the public getting involved in it.
The panel will return after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue, on air this morning with Terry Gibson, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Pondicio. We are discussing the possibility that they are also discussing in Washington of releasing the videos of the strikes on the alleged drug ships. Excuse me. We have letters to continue the conversation. This from Ruth, who says, it's hard to believe that these boat strikes are anything but performative. The Washington Post points out that Trump has pardoned or granted clemency to 100 drug dealers and kingpins, including some of the biggest in the world. So this is not about drugs. He doesn't care about drugs, or these people would be left to die in prison instead of walking free. So what is it about? Regime change to get oil? With this administration, always follow the money. We also heard from Kieran, who says, I think this goes back to what Arthur Schlesinger called the imperial presidency back in the 1960s. Congress has delegated so much of its authority, often due to its own inefficiency and gridlock, to the executive branch. The fault is primarily on Congress for allowing the president to have so much power. And as we are seeing with the current president, if you really want to push the envelope on presidential authority, you can. Rachel wrote in and said, the panel is incorrect as to what Trump is doing being new. Yes, Obama and Biden did use drones, but there was congressional authorization in the areas in which they were operating. That was all noted. That was noted all weekend on all the news shows. I don't think it's useful to normalize what the Trump administration is doing. This is not normal. This is murder. And this is not something that the other administrations have done. Acknowledge that and then have a discussion. That is a point from Rachel. And Marianne wrote in and said, I try to think beyond reacting to the latest thing. The point, I think, from the letters and comments I have heard on air so far is that we not only need to hold the chain of command in these current events to account from bottom to top, but we have to fundamentally challenge and change those things that presidents and military leaders are relying on over decades. Trump is not doing anything new, says Marianne. He's just doing horrible, murderous things in even poorer taste than every president preceding him, at least in my lifetime. Warm regards from Mary. Robert.
I'm actually Googling right now congressional authorization for the war on terror, just because the letter writer made a point that if he or she is correct, I'm simply unfamiliar with. I remember there was an wouldn't be called a memorandum of understanding, but there was some manner of policy document that the Obama administration released, but I don't believe there was ever a congressional authorization or a declaration of war in the so-called war on terror. But during the break, we were discussing the Obama drone strikes, which I think, you know, are again, apples and oranges. But it was massive. There were over 500 drone strikes in Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere, nearly 3,800 casualties, including four U.S. citizens. So, you know, we and it doesn't sound like we're not pretending that this is unique to the Trump administration, but it is, again, at the risk of, you know, repeating myself, this has been something that every administration has done at some scale, at some time or another. So it was not what the framers intended, and if Congress is ready to kind of, if not call a halt to it, then at least demand some accountability for it, then that's a good thing.
Terry?
Well, I would have to go back and do significant research, but I feel comfortable in saying, just based on how I have followed these issues, that it may comparative in scale, it may be very small, but I believe that every president going back to at least Nixon has taken some action using the military for something that was not approved by Congress. Now, I agree that Donald Trump is taking it to a whole new level, and I possibly using it for entirely different purposes. And I'm not convinced that there's a sincere security risk behind any of this. And I'm not convinced that any of this is helping make us safer. Either way, whether it's one president or 10 presidents, it shouldn't be allowed. And there is a role for Congress that is not being upheld. And we, the people, should hold our congressional members accountable for holding the president accountable. And we should also hold the president accountable. And that is somewhat hard to do when you're relying on the messaging of what actually happened to come from what are essentially political operatives. You have politicians are the ones that are sharing the stories with us about what they saw. And that's always should be suspect, regardless of what party you're in. We need to see these videos so that we can decide for ourselves what is happening and then take the appropriate course of action and put pressure where we think it needs to be placed.
Yeah. Anna?
And I do think that one of the comment writers mentioned kind of keeping the bigger picture in mind with regiment change in Venezuela. And I think that is a legitimate concern here. President Trump does not approve of the current president. And I do wonder what his end goal is with all of these strikes and what he wants to actually see accomplished. If it was just a war on drugs, then he wouldn't have helped the former Honduras president, who was a convicted drug cartel leader. So what is the end goal? What are we trying to accomplish? And should any of this be legal? What are our goals as a country? And do we support this? So,
Robert?
Well, I'm not sure I would go about it this way, but for the record, I'm in favor of regime change in Venezuela as well. Maduro is not a good guy.
Panel at WAMC.org to continue the conversation. We move on now to New Orleans, and state and federal authorities are closely tracking online criticism and demonstrations against the immigration crackdown in New Orleans. This from CNN. The officials are monitoring message boards around the clock for threats to agents while compiling regular updates on public, quote, sentiment surrounding the arrests, according to law enforcement records that were reviewed by the Associated Press. The intelligence gathering comes even as officials have released few details about the first arrest made last week as part of what they are calling the Catahoula Crunch, prompting calls for greater transparency from local officials who they say have been kept in the dark about virtually every aspect of the operation. Online opinions still remain mixed, with some supporting the operations while others are against them, said a briefing circulated early Sunday to law enforcement. Earlier bulletins noted a combination of groups urging the public to record ICE and Border Patrol, as well as, quote, additional locations where agents can find immigrants. Immigration authorities have insisted the sweeps are targeted at illegal aliens, but the law enforcement records detail criminal histories for less than a third of the 38 people arrested in the first 2 days of the operation. Local leaders told the AP those numbers, which law enforcement officials were admonished not to distribute to the media, undermined the stated aim of the roundup. They also expressed concern that the online surveillance could chill free speech as authorities threatened to charge anyone interfering with the immigration enforcement. It confirms what we already knew, that this is not about public safety. It's about stoking chaos and fear and terrorizing communities. That from Senator Royce Duplessis, a Democrat who represents New Orleans. He continues, it is furthering a sick narrative of stereotypes that immigrants are violent. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security did not respond to the questions about the intelligence gathering and referred the AP to a prior news release touting dozens of arrests. The agency has not released an accounting of the detainees taken into custody or their alleged or existent or not criminal histories. Anna?
I mean, I think this entire thing is disgusting and shouldn't be happening in any of our cities or any of our communities. And if you look at what is happening at a national level, the tactics that they're taking is not arresting violent criminals. They are going to court proceedings of U.S. citizens who are trying to get their spouses to be citizens and detaining them, some of them holding babies. Like, these are not violent criminals. They are married to Americans who are trying to become Americans to be with their families. Locally, actually, one of Communities for Local Power's alumni, who was a Bard student and an Afghan asylum seeker who escaped the Taliban, was arrested as he was at a hearing trying to be granted asylum. He was detained and is still in a detention center awaiting his legal hearing that he has a right to. And, you know, these are the tactics that are happening across America, and they're going to happen in New Orleans. And they're trying to just stoke fear, and it's terrible.
Robert?
I don't sound hard-hearted. I'm not interested in relitigating the merits of these raids. I think what's more interesting is the larger political reality of this story and others like it. Obviously, immigration enforcement was the signature issue of this president, right? So voters knew exactly what they were voting for. This wasn't hidden in fine print. It was front and center. So the interesting question to me now is whether the critics of the president, well, it's not whether the critics, with all due respect, Anna, dislike this. That was baked into the pie. The deeper question is whether these enforcement policies, the one that put him back in the White House, are still popular among those who did vote for this president. I don't have polling data in front of me, but I believe last time I looked, it was either a Pew poll or a New York Times poll that showed that Trump is still, his approval rating is, what, about 40%, but he's still slightly higher than that on immigration. Voters who voted for this president still support this president and a little bit extra on immigration. Now, you know, we'll have another election after this, so we'll get to see if that holds. But right now, it does look like among folks who voted for this president, they like this.
Terry?
Well, I think what's happening right now is that Americans are being confronted with really having to decide what they think it means to be American. And to me, what's going on in our cities with ICE seems to me un-American. It seems borderline, if not outright illegal in many cases. It seems to be denying people their right to the judicial system. It seems to be denying people the right to really defend themselves. It seems to be denying people the right of freedom of speech. And to me, that all seems un-American. If there are individuals that have legitimately broken the law, and have legitimately not been held accountable by that, by legal standards, then they should be arrested. But I don't see evidence that that is really what's happening here, especially when you go in with these mass raids with, you know, small armies that are going in for hundreds of people at a time. It's hard for me to see how they have somehow efficiently determined that everyone that they're corralling into that one group is a criminal. And we're seeing evidence, which I believe to be credible in most cases over and over again, that many of the people being arrested are either not criminals, or whatever crime they have committed is very much sort of in the petty category and isn't really worthy of this type of assault. There are other ways to deal with that. The devastating effect that it's having just on the security and safety and just day-to-day life of just communities, valuable communities that really are providing so much of the labor and workforce and heart and soul of these big cities is just devastating. And I would like to see it curtailed. I would like to see it. I would like to see those who are in charge of it be held accountable to really showing us what it is that they are doing in a more transparent way, so that once again we can decide whether we believe that this is really something that we can support. And there's so much being withheld from us. It's just not a transparent process.
Yeah, I don't want to be a pedant, but sometimes the coverage of this issue is misleading. In other words, and maybe the administration is to blame for this because they keep talking about violent criminals. But by definition, if you are here as an undocumented person in this country, you have committed a crime, right? I mean, I think we have to be clear-eyed about that. By the way, there was another story in the New York Times this morning, which I only had time to briefly scan, which was surprising to me. It was a rather pointed takedown of the Biden administration's indifference to this issue. I wish I had it in front of me. But they had a number of on-the-record sources on this who said, look, you know, the Biden administration was concerned with the economy. They were concerned with COVID. They just did not take this seriously, and they handed this issue to Trump.
I mean, I think that the only reason that Trump has any popularity on this topic at all is because of the messaging of violent criminals. And a lot of people aren't following the news close enough to know that that isn't really what's happening here, that it is far broader than violent criminals that are being detained. And I think if that were clear, the scale and scope, it would be less popular. But regardless of that, and on your comment about it just being illegal for them to be here, in general, a lot of folks who are going through the formal asylum process are being arrested at their hearings. They're trying to follow the process. And by doing that, the administration is then scaring people away from showing up to those hearings, which they legally need to do. And then if they miss their hearing, then they're violating another law. And so they're really creating, putting people between a rock and a hard place of, do you show up and get arrested or do you not show up and then you're a criminal and you're arrested? And so really, I think their goal is to have less immigrants, and the way that they're going about it is not okay.
But that brings me back to my original point, which was, this is what got this man elected, was exactly the stance that you just described, Anna.
Panel at WAMC.org to participate in the conversation. Our panelists this morning, Terry Gibson, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Pondicio. We will return after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Terry Gibson, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Pondicio. You can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. That is the method by which we hear from Jeffrey, who says, I just take issue with the implicit assertion that since voters theoretically voted for this, those of us who oppose the immigration enforcement actions of the administration should just accept it. I also think that a good number of those voters were truly convinced he was going after the violent elements among undocumented immigrants, which is to your point, Anna.
Yeah, maybe. I do remember the phrase border security coming up quite a lot. But yes, also a discussion of violent criminals and gang members and MS-13 and whatnot. Absolutely.
Parker writes in and says, I think the biggest problem with this entire administration is laziness. They are not doing the real work. actually investigating and finding evidence of wrongdoing, whether it's boats carrying drugs or someone suspected of a crime, it is all a fictional TV show to them. Guy writes in and says,
yes.
Go ahead, Terry. Just yes.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summation. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Guy writes in and says, immigration was pinned to affordability. I think Trump supporters are surprised how much this Keystone Cops purge is costing directly and indirectly. Also, you panelists get civil and criminal law violations mixed up. I'm not a criminal if I do something that means a civil claim can be brought against me. That's from Guy. And Mark says, support of Hispanic voters who endorse Trump's emphasis on legal immigration has substantially eroded over these methods, including ethnic profiling and targeting Venezuelans and Cubans.
I'm not sure that's right, because this morning in preparation for the roundtable, I was looking at a Pew poll that surprised me because it showed just the opposite, that yes, there has been, among Latino voters, there has been some small softening of support. Latino voters who voted for Trump still strongly support him and still strongly, it is eroded, but not that much.
Panel at WAMC.org to continue the conversation, weigh in as you wish. A point listeners make a lot. That I'll just read this and then we can see if it sparks anything. But Travis says, our current president, his ancestors were German and Scottish. So in fact, he is from immigrant descent himself, of course, unless you are.
We all are.
American Indian, Indigenous American, free peoples. Then we're all of immigrant descent.
Mm-hmm.
Panel at WAMC.org. Before our next break, let's set up a new topic, and then I imagine, will return to it after the newscast. This is about education standards in the United States. This coverage, a mix of verbiage from Vice and The Atlantic. The latest data from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP, nicknamed the nation's report card, shows that today's American high school seniors, and then college freshmen and college students, are even less educated than we suspected. In 2024, math and reading skills have plunged to historic lows. 12th graders scored the lowest in math since 2005 and the lowest in reading since the assessments began in 1992. The instinct by many is to blame COVID and pandemic lockdowns, and that does contribute, but it doesn't explain why those numbers were already on the downturn before the pandemic. According to Matthew Soldner, acting commissioner at the National Center for Education Statistics, the decline has been brewing for years, especially among the lowest performing students, and COVID kicked the crumbling foundation out from under the whole system. The education system topic proffered to us by Robert Pondicio, who we will let, of course, have the first word after my setup here.
And you have to throw this out a few minutes before a break, because
I'll use the rest
of the hour to talk about this.
We'll come back, Sarah, and do a bunch. It really matters.
Yeah, no, it does. And it's a deadly serious topic. And I'm going to take slight issue with my NCES colleague who says that, COVID is not the primary cause. I mean, yes, there has been some softening. And by the way, NAEP, I love the fact that we're talking about NAEP. And this is what I do for a living, is talk about the so-called nation report card.
The National Assessment of Educational Progress.
It goes back to the Nixon administration. It was renormed in the 90s, so sure. But what COVID did, it was, I'm not making this up, it literally vaporized 25 years of progress on math. But it's a perfect storm. It's not just COVID. I mean, I happen to have been a supporter of Common Core. But when you change the way math is taught, as we did in the early 2000-teens, then it takes a while for that to be metabolized, so to speak, by the system. It was starting to creep up a little bit, then COVID hit. But you've got so many other factors, Sarah. I mean, it's a bit of a perfect storm. You have kind of antipathy to standardized testing. You have colleges going test optional. The reason this is making news right now, some of our listeners may have heard, there was a, I don't want to call it a scandal, but UC San Diego, which is an elite college in California. It turns out that 1 out of 8 of their freshman class could not do middle school math. And this is not, a community college. This is an elite selective admissions college. So you have to assume that if it's that bad at UC San Diego, well, what must it be elsewhere? I wrote a piece about this for the American Enterprise Institute a few weeks ago, and my point was, if this surprises you, you've not been paying attention because of the decline in math standards, because of COVID, because of test-blind admissions, because, frankly, our concern of valorizing equity. Now, look, you know, I'm a former South Bronx school teacher. I've never taught a white kid in my life. My entire career is predicated on advancing the interests of low-income black and brown students. But when you lower standards in the name of equity, you're doing them a disservice. You should be insisting on excellence for kids, not merely lowering the bar so they can get in, because all you're doing then is kicking the can down the road. You're putting them in situations where they're doomed to fail. So I am beyond troubled by this. This is this. On the one hand, this is not surprising, but I take no satisfaction in saying that. This is, we're going to be paying the price for this for a very, very long time.
Panel at WAMC.org to continue the conversation. That's panel at WAMC.org. We will return to this topic and discuss more about it after this break. Our panelists this morning, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, executive director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead, Anna Markowitz, and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio. Again, the email address to further the conversation, panel at WAMC.org. If you write in, please do keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments. Don't use obscure abbreviations or clarify them if you must. And proofread your emails if you have a sec before you send in, just for clarity, making sure your message does come across without completely flustering your fill-in host this morning. We will return with more of the roundtable panel after this. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, joined by preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, executive director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead, Anna Markowitz, and senior fellow at the Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel at WAMC.org. Before the newscast, we set up a story about declining education accomplishments of U.S. students. And Robert made his first points. I would like Anna to follow up now, and we will continue this topic.
Sure. In a prior life, I was a third grade science teacher. So I also started an education nonprofit. So I love following education news. I'm also a mom to a 10 and 13 year old, and I see it in action all the time. I personally blame screens. I think that if you're sitting in a class and you're allowed to have your phone with you and your math teacher is maybe boring, though I love math and it is never boring, you might be distracted to go to YouTube or start texting your friends. And if you have that access and you miss math, it's not one of those subjects that you can just, you know, read an essay later and catch up on it and figure out how to do it on your own. You really need to be paying attention in class. And so I'm going to be really curious to see how new state laws, like in New York State, this is the first year that we have had a ban on cell phones in school. How does that impact the test scores and the math scores? And hopefully we use that. My hypothesis is that it's going to improve them. And so will other states follow suit? Because I think that I went to grad school a few years ago. It was the first time I was in school when things like computers and cell phones existed, because I'm old.
Hardly. Hardly.
But I would be listening. I didn't.
Well, if you are, I am. And yeah. So
right?
Fine.
And so I would be listening to the teacher, and I didn't have my computer open, but I was sitting, you know, in the back row, and I could see all the other students in front of me all online shopping instead of listening to the professor. And then lo and behold, they would complain about how hard the tests were because they weren't paying attention. They were buying shoes. Yeah. So, you know, if I think that we need to ban the screens, we're going to find that we recover. And then, you know, there are other things. COVID definitely did exacerbate it, but we can't blame COVID forever.
You can blame COVID until the egg is out of the python, so to speak. In other words, think the college freshmen that we're talking about were what, in middle school during COVID. So that means they lost, at least here in New York, one entire year, and then by fits and starts, parts of two subsequent school years. And if we're talking in particular about math, then yeah, that is kind of a coherent, cumulative, sequential area of study, right? In other words, first you learn your numbers, then add, subtract, then percents and decimals and ratios, then higher math. You know, you can't have that fits and starts kind of education. And by the way, COVID, the gift that keeps on giving, you know what it has been replaced by is chronic absenteeism. I mean, the rates of chronic absenteeism, COVID kind of normalized not going to school. And we've got an ongoing chronic problem with kids missing, you know, it's defined as if you're missing more than 20% of, in some states, 10%. That's a lot of school to be missing when you're talking about, again, a sequential area of study. So, I take your point, Anna. At some point, we got to stop talking about it, but probably not. I mean, look, frankly, the kids I'm really worried about, I'm more of a literacy guy than a math guy. If your formative years of school, your early childhood elementary school, happened during COVID, then you missed out on those, you know, those basic literacy skills, the phonics and whatnot. So as bad as this is, please may I be wrong about this, but I fear in a couple of years we're going to be seeing this and worse when it comes to literacy.
I mean, so my son, who's 10, was in kindergarten during COVID, and in fact showed up to first grade having spent, instead of time in kindergarten, he was at a farm camp with chickens, not learning phonics. And so he showed up to first grade and didn't know how to read. And he was caught up pretty well. You know, I think that the schools were anticipating that there would be people who were coming to school behind. And they caught him up. And so now he's in fifth grade and he's caught up. So I think that, you know, at some point, if you missed 1 year or 2 years very early on, we should be able to catch them up.
If I may, yes and no. I mean, without knowing a thing about your personal history, I'm guessing your children had the benefit of, you know, college educated parents who spoke in full sentences, who engaged them in rich dinner table conversation. The fact that he went to farm camp, that's not a net negative. That's building background knowledge. Yeah. Okay, that helps with literacy. The kids that I worry about are the kids that I used to teach in places like the South Bronx and Harlem. I used to refer to them as school-dependent learners. In other words, if they didn't get it in school, they didn't get it at all. So those are the kids that I'm. And by the way, we are seeing this back to NAEP, Sarah, in the data. The kids in the 10th percentile are absolutely being devastated by this. The gap between the 90th percentile kids, Anna's kids, and the 10th percentile kids is as wide as it's ever been and getting wider.
Yeah.
Your son was at least touching hay, if not grass. So that's good.
No. Obviously, it could be much worse. And I taught in East New York, Brooklyn, we had kids that would show up to the first day of kindergarten having never seen a book, holding them literally upside down.
Can't write their own name, don't know their ABCs. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously they were not, you know, getting those skills at home,
that's right.
Which is unfortunate.
Terry Gibson, your thoughts on this topic?
Well, I've been in higher education since 2016, and I only teach communication courses and have during that entire time and continue to do so. So I don't see, fortunately for me, I don't really see their lack of math skills because we don't really get into math. And I'm really grateful for that, actually. But I do see and have seen ever since 2016, well before COVID, a slow decrease in just what I would consider the overall critical thinking skills and in all the areas that I teach in, whether it's their growing inability to be able to carry on a conversation with another person face to face, or whether it's their growing decrease in their ability to be able to just articulate their thoughts to say me when I ask them a question or to others. And certainly you see it in their writing skills, slow decrease of their ability to write. And I also very much attribute so much of that to just the overuse of screens.
Yep.
Well before COVID, I saw that impact. But certainly during and certainly after COVID, there was a substantial radically obvious decrease in all those areas. And I am now teaching, freshman, first-year students that were part of that COVID generation. And you can see it. You can see it across the board that they really missed out on so much of that critical period in growth where you need that socialization, you need to be around people, you need to be around role models. And between the screen time and the COVID isolation, it has really, really been detrimental. And I think we're going to be working really hard over the next decade to try to correct that. And one of the things that we can get into this, it's a part of it too, but one of the things I think makes it challenging, and there's a lot of things that make it challenging, but the invention of AI mm-hmm. and its role in just day-to-day activities now and how it's now entering into the education field is going to create another challenge in that front.
Yeah, I just wrote a piece about this. We call it cognitive offloading in education. It is now entirely likely, and Terry, you're probably going to see this, although if you haven't, you will, where students may submit work that looks great, right? It is coherent, it's well written, and it is untouched by human hands. They're outsourcing their thinking, and now they're writing to AI. And at the risk of being somewhat macabre about it, now you're going to have professors grading it using AI. So it's entirely possible there are papers out there that have A's on them that were not written by a human being and not read by one either. This is going to be a real problem. But Sarah, if I can offer some advice to any education journalists that might be listening to us, the real challenge is accountability here. And what I mean by that is, we keep talking about NAEP, which I'm thrilled to be on a public radio talk show talking about the National Assessment of Educational Progress, because it's not subject to human manipulation. This test has at least a 30-year provenance. It is the gold standard of educational research. So what does it tell you if NAEP is flat or going down, but graduation rates are going up, state test scores are going up? It tells you someone's lying to you, right? So there's going to be a lot of work for education journalists in the next decade. And frankly, especially here in New York, where we have lowered cut scores very quietly on our state tests. I used to see this back in the day when I was teaching in the Bronx, where I had kids who were literally counting on their fingers, during the state test, and would get threes and fours on grade level and above grade level. And then they kind of brought that down. They raised the cut scores to bring them more in line with NAEP. But they've been reducing them again. So we're going to start to see this again. So, we all want to put COVID in our rearview mirror. But when your local school superintendent or school board says, oh, look, we've recovered, the graduation rates are up, the test scores are up, be very skeptical. We haven't even talked about this thing called credit recovery, which is my new hobby horse. It is entirely possible now, likely even, that a kid will graduate with a so-called credit recovery credit. In other words, you may fail algebra, but then you can sit in front of a screen, these hated screens, for a weekend, do a couple of units, a couple of multiple choice tests, and then mirabile dictu, you've passed algebra. And there's no way, back to the UC San Diegos of the world, there's no way to know. If when you're looking at a high school student's transcript, you have no idea. Did they get that credit for algebra or geometry the old-fashioned way, sitting in course, taking the test, getting the A, or was it through online credit recovery? And it's just one more example of how, and I hate to sound cynical, how adults manipulate the data, juke the stats, as they used to say on The Wire, to make themselves look good. And because who doesn't want to say, oh, look, we've recovered. We told you we'd catch the kids up, and look, we did. The graduation rates are up. The test scores are up. Yeah, but is it a mirage or is it real?
Elizabeth writes into panel at WAMC.org and adds, having taught for 31 years at the high school level, I do recognize that expectations and standards have eroded, but it's not just that. The number of parents that are just interested in grades versus learning something is overwhelming. Holding standards high is a losing battle when parents demand a better mark by threatening to go after your job. So grades are inflated, thereby avoiding dealing with unreasonable parents and kids that don't learn.
Yeah. And frankly, I've been in schools where it's just the opposite, where the parent just wants to know, well, is he going to pass? Is he going to go on to the next grade? So it cuts both ways. There's the grade-grubbing parent, and there's the just-pass-my-kid parent.
T writes in and says the UC system, that's the University of California system, has not been allowed to use race or ethnicity in admissions since the 1996 ruling. Your panelists blaming lower reading skills to allowances made for equity is another typical example of lazy individuals who blame DEI for everything. Do you want to rebut?
Well, I'm not as familiar with the UC system, but I believe that they are test blind. So I'm not sure that the writer is correct about that. Because how would you know? I mean, I guess you could make an extrapolation if you know where they live, you know, what district they're in, then you can make a guess about that. But I'm not sure that how that would work.
Another letter writer writes in and says, some people suck at math and get labeled as not being smart, despite excelling at a variety of other subjects. If math standards are held as predictors of success in college, that limits opportunities for a whole swath of students. Anecdotally, being told by our schools to just hire math tutors to achieve barely passing grades from elementary through high school students was an infuriating turn of events.
You know, there's another point, and I took it to be assumed, but I should say it explicitly. The last thing anybody should want to do is blame kids for any of this. Kids did not ask for schools to be closed. Kids did not ask for standards to be lowered. Kids did not ask to be put in front of a screen to get, you know, credit recovery so they could move on. You know, the last thing anybody should... I'm a high standards guy, right? But I'm also a raise the floor guy. I don't want to see kids just passed and be, you know, patted on the head and say, you know, here's your high school diploma, because it catches up with them in the working world. You know, so this is not about raising standards and denying kids a high school diploma without which they can't even get a job at Panera Bread, okay? None of us should want that. But we should want honesty, and we should want, you know, a system that does its job.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that, and I do think that we should have standards. I also understand the desire to have people graduate from high school. And so I think that, yeah, we need to be thinking about how do we make sure that we're catching all of the people that might have fallen behind during COVID. And I do continue to think that screens are a big problem in that, because I think that they, you know, got more addicted to screens during that process. They were sent home with laptops. And so now all of a sudden there's more technology in schools. Mm-hmm. They're not putting good controls on those screens so that people can be using school-issued devices and just watching YouTube and mm-hmm. playing video games. My kids, personally, when they weren't at farm camp, I did have them on Zoom kindergarten for a month. And my kindergartner was smart enough to put the teacher in the background and put littlebigsnakegame.io on the front ground and spent it all day playing video games while I thought he was learning, because I could hear the teacher in the other room speaking. Yeah. So if that's what my kindergartner was doing, what on earth were middle school and high schoolers doing? And so I think that this is something that, you know, now they are more addicted to screens. Yeah. They're finding ways to get around it.
Oh my
it's
goodness.
Lowering the standards.
We're talking about critical thinking skills. We're developing them by allowing kids, or they have a genius for thwarting these systems.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Talk to a teacher right now, and even when they have these yonder pouches or whatnot where you've got to turn your phone in, they have a second phone.
Yeah.
You know, they turn into one phone, and then they have the other phone. It's really, really hard to break that addiction.
Yeah, totally.
Terry, do you have any points you'd like to make?
Well, sure. It's not, you know, it's not just these kids that are addicted to screens.
Yeah.
Many of their parents are addicted to screens. I mean, just look around.
That's right.
When's the last time you were out in a crowd of people and didn't see most of them looking at a screen? I mean, society has become addicted to screens. And so the role models that many of these children have to sort of look at and determine what is correct behavior and what is not is few and far between. So they're really kind of a reflection of what's going on in society right now. But yeah, the screen thing is an amazing challenge for anybody that is in a classroom trying to teach students, whether it's first grade or in college where I am, just getting them to put their phones down, close their laptops, and engage in a conversation and critical thought process is really, really challenging. And I have found numerous ways to try to overcome that and have had success to some degree. And I have had students quite often come up to me at the end of the semester and say, thank you so much for forcing us to put our screens down and forcing us to engage in discussion and really just teaching us how to use our brains. We just don't get to do that very often anymore. I've had a lot of students in the last few years say that. They recognize that there's a problem. They recognize they're missing something. They just don't know how to stop it.
Terry, can I ask you what exactly you're doing in your classes to do that? I mean, I've been saying for a while now, bring back the blue book. Remember, we all did those, you know, those on-demand essays in class. I'm assuming that you do some of that. In other words, do you still give assignments where kids can use technology at home and hand in work that may or may not be theirs?
I do allow them to use technology to some degree to do research and to fulfill some other obligations, but mostly what I do is I rely heavily on oral communication in classroom and through assignments. So rather than turning in something that's written, they're often required to deliver it just orally speaking. And that has been extremely helpful. And a lot of the assignments require just in-class participation in discussions. And so a lot of questions are asked by me and other students to both myself and to them during class that require that they pay attention. And so they have learned that if they are looking at their phones, looking at their laptops, they get caught not paying attention. They don't hear the question, then they can't answer it. And that does affect their grade negatively. I have found just holding them accountable to talking and paying attention is sort of the best solution. Mm-hmm. Anytime I give them sort of permission to look at a screen, to write something down, to look something up, then I immediately lose them. So That's the way I approach it.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of teachers who literally don't give homework anymore because they assume it will be value subtracted. They're not learning anything, and they're going to turn in homework or written assignments that they actually didn't author because of AI.
Bridget writes in and says, go ahead, Terry.
Okay. The AI is, it's an evolving challenge. You know, it's been with us now for a while, but it's still evolving. It's getting better and better and better. I mean, I use it all the time.
I do too. I've been joking. It's making me more productive en route to making me obsolete.
Yeah. So it's, I'm old enough, I must admit, to remember back when there was an argument about whether a calculator should be allowed in a classroom, in a math course.
Yeah.
I remember that when the first really sort of high-tech calculators came out, what can these be allowed? And, eventually they were. But now, it's this AI, there's just literally nothing it can't do. And so where are we going to draw the line where people are allowed to go use it to solve math problems, to solve writing problems, to solve pretty much every problem they can think of? What are you kind of left with? What is the purpose of a human brain at that point? I think is kind of what keeps me up at night.
I'm sorry I suggested this, Sarah. This is depressing me.
Well, I don't see where any of the other stories were uplifting. So I don't think I could hold that against you.
Touché.
Panel at WAMC.org. I'll read this letter from Bridget ahead of our upcoming newscast, and then we will return and discuss this subject a bit more. We have more email that I'll share as well, but this one from Bridget to head us off. This might be an outlier view, but here goes, says Bridget. I taught in NYC public schools for 40 years. When I started, there was very little direction and no standards. It was up to individual teachers to decide what and when to teach. Mm-hmm. Beginning in the 2000s, that changed, and I think it was mostly for the best. Standards and rubrics were introduced, and also more educational leadership. I think testing hasn't caught up with the progress. Of course, I loved teaching in the old system because no one was looking over my shoulder, but it was not good for education. If you were a good, dedicated teacher, it worked, and I was. Not so much necessarily for others. We will hold that in mind and return to the panel momentarily. Here with Terry Gibson, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Pondicio, I'm Sarah LaDuke. Again, the email address is panel@wamc.org, and we'll be back after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and for Joe Donahue this morning, here with Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead Anna Markowitz, and Senior Fellow at the American Prize Institute, Robert Pondicio. Our music this morning is from an instrumental album by La Luz, L-A-L-U-Z, and the playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. We're going to continue our conversation about education standards and the decline in the United States by contributing this letter. Allison writes in and says, "Hi, other countries have children. They also have screens and had COVID. Does anyone have any examples outside of the U.S. to see what is going on there, what has succeeded, et cetera? Does your purview reach to exploring other nations, Robert?"
A little bit, yeah. I mean, this is one of those things that folks, frankly, on the left don't like to hear. But there's this idea that schools in this country, in America, are underfunded. Well, we literally spend more money per pupil than every other OECD nation on Earth, and we underperform them. So, you know, at the risk of wonking out, my work is mostly about classroom practice as opposed to policy. I'm kind of interested in teaching and learning and curriculum and whatnot, because I think that's where we've fallen behind. The UK, you know, is probably first among English-speaking countries right now. They've done a lot of good work on phonics and math. They're leaving us behind. They spend less than we do. So, you know, if your theory of change is, well, it's the money, yeah, money makes a difference, but it doesn't make as much of a difference as people think. You know, going back to the letter that you read just before the break, that 40-year veteran teacher who was talking about how she used to be able to just do what she wanted and then, you know, standards changed, that was my experience as a New York City school teacher. I was basically handed the keys to the classroom and told, figure it out. They didn't say it that way. They said, "Oh, well, Mr. Pondicio, you're the best person to know what every child needs." I'm like, "Wait a minute. You mean I don't have a curriculum? I don't have textbooks? I just got here. I can't possibly know what's best for, you know, 25 kids in the South Bronx." That has been basically the way American education has worked for a very long time. I mean, I've made a dark joke about this over the years, that if we trained air traffic controllers the way we train teachers in this country, we would basically say, "Hey, look, everybody crashes a plane their first couple of years. Don't worry about it. You get better. You figure it out." We have a real problem in this country with and I'm not a teacher basher, let me be clear, but we have a real problem with sending underprepared teachers into classrooms and expecting them to, quote, make it their own, which is code for figure it out.
L.A. writes in and says, "Freelance writer here, looking beyond the classroom, the impact of graduating people who cannot read can only further erode what is left of the publishing industry. Just today, we have heard how Forbes has abruptly laid off dozens of freelance contributors in its pursuit of financial soundness. Because you don't need as many writers when you don't have as many readers, why read when you can watch instead?" And I ask that seriously. "The devolution of reading will lead to more media eschewing print for watchability. Video not only killed the radio star, it is coming after publishing next."
Ouch. As a veteran of the publishing industry, I wish I could say anything other than I wish it weren't so, but I think it is.
David writes in and says, "It has always been an anomaly to me that in general, we don't like artificial flavor, we don't like artificial color, we don't like artificial sweeteners. We don't like artificial enhancements, and yet most people have been overly zealous cheerleaders for artificial intelligence. Intelligence, the one thing that sets humans apart from all else, it's a bit mind-numbing." That from David. Did you guys see, last month there was a long article, a feature article in New York Magazine about young people not only outsourcing their education to AI, but their fun solutions to fun things. They are also checking on AI. Here's the first graph from that article from The Cut. It says, "Recently, Betty, a Wisconsin art school student who works at a local escape room," and escape rooms, I think most people are familiar with. It is a recreational activity where there are puzzles, codes, to crack, either, you know, usually in a small group, it's they're often used as corporate team building exercises, but people go for fun too. And you, you know, obviously you're not dangerously trapped, but you are earning your way out through through teamwork and hopefully, you know, code cracking and intelligence.
My mind went to safe rooms, which no, is not the same thing.
Not quite. About three quarters of the way through this spy themed experience escape room, the players were stumped. They stood in front of a painting, magnet in hand. To solve the puzzle and escape, they had to look behind the painting, where they would find a diagram that would lead them to a nearby locker where they could that they could unlock. One of the players pulled out her phone and was like, I'm just going to ask ChatGPT how to do this. The article goes on to explain other instances and cases where the I say the youth of America, obviously it's, you know, subsets and there's always exceptions, but people instead of and they cost money to do an escape room. Like, you're paying for the experience and not to rush it through with your phone. And I was, you know, further disheartened that they're using the robots even for fun.
You know, we started the segment by saying it was a bit of a perfect storm. And it is, right? In other words, there's just nothing. I'm going to sound like that gray-haired guy, like, get off my lawn, you kids. But, man, what's going right for kids these days?
I mean, I think when we're talking about other countries and what other countries are doing differently, I think that we need to think beyond just school into like the broader systems that our children are coming to school having survived, such as a lack of health insurance, parents that are working minimum wage jobs that can't afford to live in safe houses. And so if you're looking at, you know, us falling behind with our children, I think that we could look at other support systems in Europe and say, hey, if these kids are showing up not hungry with their SNAP benefits cut, you know, not with no health insurance, with their health premiums probably doubling soon, you know, what are we doing to create a system and a culture that is supporting these youth?
Mm-hmm. You know, I just did an interview last week with a guy I've known for years by the name of Mike Goldstein. He was the founder of the Match Schools in Boston, probably just outside of our coverage area here. He is now, even though he has spent his career in education and is, you know, a revered figure in my world, his new initiative is something called the Center for Teen Flourishing. And he talks very eloquently about how do you solve the 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. problem. Mm-hmm. In other words, that's the time when kids are more likely to disappear into their screens. And he makes this point about how, like, kids who flourish have all of these other things, Anna. They do sports. They do, you know, activities. They have friend groups. They meet at Starbucks, on and on and on. You know, sometimes it's programmed. Sometimes it's just spontaneous. But his point, and I think he's right about this, is we really have to look, and I say this as somebody who works in education, we have to look beyond the school to that to solve what he calls that 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. problem.
Yep. Terry?
I was just kind of thinking more about what other countries are doing, and I did see this story recently about what Australia is doing, and so I looked it up, and starting on December 10th, which is just a few days, they are going to ban access to social media for anybody who's under the age of 16, which is interesting. I mean, first of all, the fact that they got, you know, the entire country, you know, their political system to agree on this is pretty impressive. I don't know that we could ever do that here in this country, but I'm going to be really interested to see how this goes and what the impact of it is. And so that, to me, that's a big step that I don't think any other country has really taken that I'm aware of.
Michelle wrote in and says, the question was asked what the human brain can add beyond what AI can do, and the answer is creativity, including solving problems that have not been solved before. AI is very good at answering questions, and that even, I'm adding, debatable at times, and doing things that have been solved or done before, but not solving novel problems, which is why we still need great computer scientists and engineers, as well as those working on improving systems. They need to help at a societal level.
Hey, you want to be optimistic about something as it pertains to education?
I don't know if it's possible.
Try this on for size. There's been a lot said and written about how AI is going to hollow out the educated workforce. Frankly, guys like me who, you know, put ink on paper for a living. Well, if I can't make it in think tank world anymore, if, you know, if there's going to be others out there who are going to be, you know, policy analysts or whatnot, I'll go back to teaching, and maybe so will a lot of other, you know, well-educated people You know, it's been observed over the years that one of the worst things that ever happened, good for America, good for society, bad for kids, was when women were suddenly, you know, it used to be that being a school teacher was the career first choice for you know, smart women. Then they became doctors and lawyers and whatnot, and thank goodness. So it de-skilled the teaching workforce. Well, if we're going to hollow out the educated workforce, maybe they'll go back to teaching. Silence.
Sorry.
I don't know if we've de-educated teachers. I don't know if I would agree with that. And I think it's good that we've broadened the ability for women to have jobs that aren't just teaching, because I don't think teaching is for everyone. As someone who was a teacher, and wow, boy, do I appreciate teachers. Yes. It is the hardest job ever. You know, and I think that more women than also entered the workforce, and so that, you know, they're just more working people now.
Panel at WAMC.org to continue the conversation. We will return after this brief break with our final topic of the morning. We return after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Our panelists this morning, Terry Gibson, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Pondicio. The email address to join the conversation is panel@wamc.org. Let us discuss the VA. On the eve of major expansion, this from the Washington Post, a multi-billion-dollar project to upgrade the computer systems of all departments of Veterans Affairs hospitals is beset with problems, according to some medical staff who already use it. Critical patient notes disappear. Prescriptions log the wrong dosages. One nurse said the system incorrectly listed one of her patients as dead. Mike Fought, a case manager at Mann Grand Staff VA Medical Center in Spokane, Washington, said he lost access to his patient's records for 2 days after a software update in August. Quote, "It's amazing to me," he said, "that there are still so many problems. Every time there's an update, there are unintended consequences." The program launched in 2018 to replace the aging computer system used across VA's healthcare network, which serves more than 9 million veterans, with an off-the-shelf product that could handle many of the same tasks, organizing important information, including appointments, referrals, prescriptions, and patient histories. After the system went live in 2020 at Mann Grand Staff, doctors and other users began flagging errors that caused delays in treatment and medication mix-ups, and grappling with a system that was routinely offline, according to documents and interviews. As the VA expanded to other hospitals and clinics in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Ohio, the problems followed. In March, the VA announced plans to accelerate the Federal Electronic Health Record Modernization Program in 2026 to hospitals and clinics in 5 more states. Officials say many of the problems have been addressed and they are on track to expand an improved version of the system to 13 additional medical centers and their affiliated clinics next year. I pose the question, in addition to this information that I've just read, is this not the case with systems handling civilian medical records? I'm not sure. It seems like there would be comparisons and relations there. Let us discuss. We can begin with Terry.
Well, I would have to get more detail to really be able to form, I guess, a credible opinion on this. But what I do know from my time in government is that whether it's state government or federal government, neither has a great track record of rolling out advanced technology in an effective and efficient way without any glitches. I remember when Obamacare was first rolled out. Yeah. I remember that there was glitches in that system. When you compare that to the systems that the corporate world uses, which is ultimately all about making money, you don't hear about these cases that often because it's in their best interest to have an efficient system so that their profit is sustainable. Whereas with the VA, being a government institution, there is a massive bureaucracy there that you don't see in the corporate segment. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I mostly, though, I feel very much sorry for any veteran that is losing access to treatment or is not getting the urgent care that they need due to this system. Our government should prioritize the treatment of veterans, and I don't think it has really done that to an acceptable level in quite some time.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, Terry. My first thought is, where's Elon Musk when you need him? I mean, this would have been something that he would have been pretty good at. But more earnestly, the VA exists because, you know, we made an explicit promise to those who bore the cost of our nation's wars and its defense. It's the least controversial promise we make as citizens. We owe them, you know, at the very least, quality care. So this is just a sad story.
I mean, I think that I do agree that the government doesn't have a great track record of having cutting edge technology. I do think in this case, Oracle purchased the system from the proprietors. And so this is a private company that is developing the system. Granted, they are trying to take a system that was broken and then under new ownership, fix it. You know, if you have experience working in tech platforms, you know, it can be really hard to inherit someone else's code and then make it better. So I think that there's probably some natural struggles during this transition. And the idea that they would then expand it to additional states seems really questionable. Why would you not take this moment, make sure that it's really working in the systems that it's already implemented in, make sure that it is, you know, not causing deaths, and then roll it out to more states and systems. And so I just would personally prefer to see them take their time and roll it out slowly and not expand to new hospitals if they're not serving the ones that they're currently serving well.
I'm not sure I saw it in the original piece, Sarah, but what problem was this fixing? In other words, is this an instance, as sometimes happens with government, of a solution in search of a problem? Or
I am scanning the article to see if I can figure that out. My thought is that, you know, a sort of customary, scheduled but vetted update to, you know, further digitalizing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, doctors need current information for patient care, but you know, what was the issue this was designed to fix was the question I was wondering.
Yeah, I can't access that readily, but I will add that the study found that overall care for veterans has deteriorated at the six hospital networks using the new system, according to findings from an internal VA study last year that was obtained by the Post.
Right,
and
using
the
new system.
The new system, right. And that the study found patients faced longer wait times and providers saw fewer patients, concluded that the system had a larger negative impact on VA care, according to a September 2024 presentation of the findings. In primary care, total patient visits fell by 30-40% and have not recovered at the time of this study. But I'm still, you know, as I'm reading, trying to find the answer to your question. And I think I have to abandon the search at this time,
but
can call it homework.
But I'll tell you what, those of us who love to wake up in the morning and get hot under the collar about politics, this is the stuff that really matters, right? This is the stuff that government is supposed to do and do well.
Ah, this says, here we go. President Donald Trump launched the project of Oracle to upgrade the healthcare record system early in his first term after he made a campaign promise to modernize the VA by accelerating and expanding investments in state-of-the-art technology. VA leaders said they selected this program because the Pentagon already had purchased a similar Cerner system, or Kerner. It's C-E-R-N-E-R is the name of a company, for the military's more than 700 hospitals and clinics. By adopting the same system, the VA said it could improve communication about patients with military hospitals. At the time, Shulkin told lawmakers that the program would save billions and could be implemented at every VA facility, 170 medical centers, and 1,193 outpatient care clinics within 8 years. So obviously their goals of achieving that streamlining are subject to the efficacy of the program itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it always sounds great on paper to be like, we're going to implement this new technology and it's going to make all of your problems go away. And in reality, there's always bumps. And so we just need to slow down and fix the bumps, because this is people's lives that we're talking about. This isn't just like, you know, oh no, my Amazon package didn't arrive. This is like, I got a double dose of morphine and could have serious health consequences.
Yeah. And you know what you need to fix technology, right? To bring this conversation full circle?
AI.
No. Math. You need math.
Math and, yes, good communication systems, honestly, to convey the issues and resolve them correctly.
All roads lead to education, my friends.
By the VA's own accounting, each of the six rollouts has been followed by reports of harm to veterans served by those hospital networks. Last year, VA spokesman Gary Kunich confirmed by email that the new system was deemed a potentially causal factor in the deaths of six patients. In August, the VA disclosed updated statistics gathered by the Veterans Health Administration National Center for Patient Safety, which reviews reports of potential harm from clinicians, noting that the new record system played a role in 4,601 cases of harm. We have an email from Steve who says, in 2018, the VA billed me for a visit and procedure I never had. As I am not on VA disability, I pay a copay. They docked my Social Security benefits until I could pay the non-existent bill. I reached out to Senator Chris Murphy, and he was able to contact the administration and got my money back. That from Steve.
Huh. Well, I guess that answers the question as to why they're doing it, at least in part.
Another listener writes in and says, I worked in medical IT for 25 years, and if you only knew how many poor products there are for EMRs, you would not believe it. We always used to ask, how come Microsoft doesn't create a contract with the government to not only invent a good program, but also standardize it like Windows?
Yeah, hey, I'm familiar with enough education technology products that I'm nodding vigorously along with that letter.
Another letter from Andy says, as a data engineer in healthcare IT, so exactly who we need.
Yes. Hello.
I can tell you that the VA source data is difficult to work with. It is written in MUMPS, M-U-M-P-S, and is an archaic data architecture that is not widely known. Second, I would wager that each facility or region probably has different data structures in this archaic system. And Dolores writes in and says, the pronunciation for Cerner is Cerner. That company that I didn't know if it started with a hard C or a soft is an S. Thank you, Dolores. But she also says, I taught doctors and nurses in various hospital medical applications for 11 years. Anyone I taught that had worked with the original VA application said it was clunky but reliable. This is another Trump administration decision that is not thought out.
I mean, I understand the desire to improve a clunky old government system. And, you know, I'm sure it was done with the heart of serving veterans. Just, you know, you need to pay attention to the execution. Doesn't seem like that was went well.
Panel at WAMC.org to continue the conversation, although I probably shouldn't be announcing that at this particular moment as the show is wrapping up. But we'll return tomorrow and you can keep that email address in mind for that conversation. Thank you to today's panelists, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations at the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Always a pleasure to speak with you, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was a good time.
Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead, Anna Markowitz. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
And Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Our pitch hitter today, called in yesterday, short notice, Robert Pondicio. Thank you, Robert.
My pleasure, Sarah. Thanks.
You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.